Welcome, everyone. Those who are listening live and those who are listening this after the fact, this is the seventh office hours session for money monopoly and market intervention. Is that what we're calling this? And it is, what is it, November of 2011, just to give a time stamp in case future historians, archaeologists dig this up. So, as a typical in office hour session, we will throw it open to the people who are tuned in live here. Incidentally, I have been working my way today through all the accumulated questions you guys have been posting in the forum. I'm not totally done, but I worked my way back to like week three at this point. So I got through most of them, but I'm getting bogged down because I think in week three you guys had a ton of questions for me. So the first question out of the chute is from Bharat, who says, what happened to your blog? Well, that's a long story. And since we have time, I can tell it. But if anybody is here tuned in who actually has a question about economics, go ahead and post that. But until I see such a question, I'll give you the story. So I have this web hosting thing called, the name of the company is Fat Cow. And I'm telling you that so if you're ever thinking of hosting a blog somewhere, don't use them. And I was traveling and I got a message, an email saying that my blog was using too many resources from their database or something, or sending too many inquiries to their database. And I have no idea what that even means. And it said, you know, rectify this immediately or we're going to suspend your blog. And I kind of hoped the problem would disappear and it didn't. So then at some point, yeah, my blog just said it's been suspended. So I called them up and said, what do I have to do? I don't even know what you're talking about. And they said, well, what are you using it for? And I said, well, it's a blog. And they said, well, maybe you could try using a caption. But then the guy was looking at it and goes, oh, no, what happened is there's lots of spam and porn in your comments. And I said, what are you talking about? You know, because I actually monitor them pretty closely. And like, yeah, we get spammed, and I just send them all in the trash. And I said, like, is it, you know, still in your memory? Because I didn't empty the trash or something, because there's nothing offensive that's visible to someone who goes to my blog at this point. What are you talking about? And the guy was like, well, I can't tell you. I'm just reading the same error ticket. So it was like when I called their customer service, the guy I talked to, all he could see was the same email that I got. It was like some other department. And so in the email, like they told me what I needed to do for them to turn my blog back on, said, you know, go here, log in, blah, blah, blah. And where it took me to was a list of every blog comment on my blog since it started. So, I mean, there's like literally thousands of little line items, you know, in their database, the way they store it. And the thing just said to me, so go through that and clean out any spam or, you know, porn comments, and then we'll restore it. I mean, that would literally take me 30 hours. And so I, you know, told this guy, can you be more specific, like to tell me the date where these comments are, because, you know, I'm not going to scroll through thousands of comments when I don't even know what I'm looking for. And he was like, and that's when he said, oh, no, I don't know what to tell you. I don't have any more information than you do. And so I was waiting for him to, you know, refer me to the person that did have more information. And he said, no, what you got to do is just hit reply to that email and talk to him that way. So the point was calling their customer support was not supportive. So anyway, apparently my blog is, I didn't do a single thing. And they put my blog back up. So I guess I'm just going to wait for them to get mad at me again and take my blog off for a couple days. So fortunately, that blog is a hobby, and it's not like I depend on it for my livelihood. Otherwise, I'd be pretty upset. So that's the story of what happened to my blog, Bharat. Yeah, it should be, unless they took it down again. Sometimes what you might need to do is like reload your – I don't even know what terminology I'm using – but you know how sometimes you go to a website and it's showing you the page you saw before and you gotta like reload it. Any other questions? Well, while you guys are thinking, let me say that some people have been sending me links to, apparently Brad DeLong has been on the warpath lately about Mises' views on gold and depression and such, saying that Mises is suffering from a mental disorder. And so anyway, I'll be addressing. The first one, I just let it go because it was too obnoxious and he wasn't. But then he followed up with it, and then Krugman linked to it, and it's like now everyone's talking about it, like in the, you know, the responsible, serious economists are all like, oh yes, that Mises is quite crazy, and everyone in the comments is psychoanalyzing Austrian sympathizers and how we're all nuts, and it's because we, anyway, the thing that's particularly obnoxious about it is, well, there's two things. One is DeLong actually referred to the fans of Mises as something like unmannerly, like people who don't have manners, which is kind of funny because, anyway, well, I'll just say it's funny. And then the other thing that was ironic is he's chastising Mises for believing in the labor theory of value. And you might say, what? And you'd be right to say that. Where DeLong is coming from is because he had this quote from Mises saying that expansions of the money supply only cause you know, the boom bust cycle. They don't lead to genuine prosperity. And so DeLong, you know, he's staring at that paragraph, and the only sense he can make out of it, and I'm not putting words in his mouth, this is what, you know, this is what he's blogging about. The only sense he can make out of it is to say that well, I'll give you guys the link since you might not know what I'm talking about. Is that so this, what I'm posting here now is like the second thing. And you can tell that because he says follow up. So though, I mean, if you want to glance at it now, probably more interesting what I'm gonna talk about, but where, just to finish that train of thought, where he's coming from is to say that, I'm staring at this proposition from Mises that credit expansion can only lead to, you know, can inevitably just lead to a boom-bust cycle and not, it doesn't bring real prosperity. And the only thing I can, you know, how could Mises possibly think that? How could he support gold as money, but then at the same time deny that injections of either fiduciary media or fiat money, I mean, DeLong's not using those terms, but that's what Mises means. How could he deny that that could help sometimes? You know, how could he so categorically think that injecting unbacked paper money doesn't bring prosperity if at the same time Mises is a fan of the gold standard? And so the only thing DeLong can come up with is to say, oh, Mises must think the reason gold is legitimate is because people had to actually go dig it up. And like they had to put their toil into it, and so therefore Mises is actually, you know, suffering from a throwback to the labor theory of value here. But actually, DeLong continues in his lecture against Mises, value is subjective, and the reason gold is, or the reason we value money is because of its purchasing power, not because of its intrinsic properties. And yeah, then he goes from there. So I mean, someone has to write something, and since I just wrote the study guide to the theory of money and credit, I guess it falls upon me to do it, because it's not just that, oh wait, no, Mises didn't think that, Mr. DeLong. It's that Mises was literally the one economist in history, if you had to pick someone to say who was it that developed the subjective value theory application to money, it would be Ludwig von Mises in the theory of money and credit. So I mean, it would be like saying, me saying, yeah, I don't understand this quote from Keynes. Doesn't Keynes realize that sometimes the market economy can get stuck at less than full employment because of insufficient aggregate demand? I mean, that's basically analogous to what DeLong did there. In addition to, if I picked a quote from Keynes that, you know, if you were a Keynesian, would make total sense to you, and I just completely, you know, misunderstood it almost willfully. Anyway, okay, I got that off my chest now. Let's see if you guys have any. Okay, yeah, you guys got all kinds of questions. George Smith said, Krugman says Mises is crazy. Just to clarify, I mean, it was Brad DeLong who was saying Mises was suffering from a mental disorder. Krugman linked to it approvingly. But technically, let's keep our, let's not start any rumors here. it was Brad DeLong who said that Mises had a mental disorder. Barat says, it doesn't even seem like they're arguing against him. It's just like they're saying his ideas and applying their dumb. Well, sometimes they do that, Barat. Sometimes you're right. They'll just quote something from Mises and be like, whoa, get a load of that guy, and then just move on as if it's self-explanatory how crazy he is. But this time, they're quoting him and then totally misunderstanding what he's saying and then lecturing him for not understanding that value is subjective when it comes to money. So, this, I know what you're saying. They do that a lot, but this time I think they actually are, like, ridiculing his ideas. It's just the idea they attribute to him is incorrect. He doesn't believe that. Okay, Jeff Leskovar says, who is buying the bond? Who is on the other side of those trades when Italian bonds are crashing, for example? Well, I mean, lots of people. Right, so it's not like I can say, oh, it's this guy, Jim Brown, who lives in Albuquerque. I mean, there's lots of institutions or whatever that are holding them. So just, I mean, you're actually raising a good point. It's anytime something is selling and you see the market price crashing, you know, there's this idea that, oh, my gosh, that asset is in free fall and nobody's touching it with a 10-foot pole. But no, that's not true. To see the price going down means that there are trades occurring at all those prices. And so somebody is paying those prices each step of the way. So what happens is somebody, there are speculators, for example, that might think that, oh, there's a panic, this is temporary, we think the ECB is going to come in and prop these things up. So yeah, I'll pick them up at these low prices, and then hopefully they'll recover next week, and then I'll get rid of them back to an institutional investor. So there's probably some of that going on. Also, I don't have the numbers in my hands here, but the ECB is buying a lot of all the pigs' debt. So they could be the major player on the other side. I don't know. I haven't looked at the volumes and seen what the ECB has been doing. Okay. Gilberto says, I read a comment by someone, can't remember the name, a mainstream economist, where he links going back to the gold standard to going back to believing that the sun revolves around the earth. How would you refute this idea? Well, I'd say from a certain perspective, the sun does revolve around the earth, but no viewpoint is privileged, and for all I know, I'm at the center of the universe. I bet you probably wanted me to go the other way with that question. I mean, it's when you're dealing with something like that, I almost don't want to, you're not going to convince somebody like that. I mean, they're that hostile to the idea such that they're going to say, let me put it this way. Milton Friedman never bothered me on the gold standard. I mean, I disagreed with him, but the way he dealt with it in, I think it was Capitalism and Freedom, but I might be wrong. But in one of his, essays for the layperson, but that was a little bit highbrow, he went through and he explained how the classical gold standard worked, and he basically admitted, I don't remember the exact words, but he basically admitted that the gold standard would be good to restrain governments and prevent them from inflating. But he just thought that, in our day and age, it's politically impossible, and also, there could be emergencies where we have to go to war, for example, and maybe we can't raise the needed revenue just from taxes and even borrowing, so we need to turn to the printing press just to prevent the country from getting taken over by some hostile, aggressive nation. So, on balance, Friedman says, I'm for not having a gold standard and just but using these wise monetarist policies when conducting monetary policy. So like I say, I disagree with that, but okay, fair enough. He's not saying that the gold standard is goofy. He's just saying, I think that it served its purpose in its time, but now we know better and we can do better than that. okay, like I say, I think he's wrong, but fair enough. But when people are just shooting their mouth off and saying, like the comments, not DeLong himself, but the people in his comments, just saying stuff like, oh yeah, the reason Ron Paul and all his fans like gold is because, you know, they want to rub it and it gives them a thrill or something. I mean, they think it's like we just have some weird fetish for yellow metal or something, and that we don't have legitimate arguments behind it. So when you encounter people like that, I mean, it's almost not worth debating them, because it's not like you're going to say something and they're going to say, oh, I never thought of it like that. Okay, you convinced me. I mean, they're not even trying to understand it. They're that hostile to the idea and ridicule it and just can dismiss all of the economists, you know, who were for it, and all, you know, all the statesmen and stuff who were at one time were for it, and just say, oh, they're a bunch of idiots. So, I mean, I don't know what else to tell you except to say, I mean, there are, put it this way, there are a lot more economists now who believe that the gold standard either is a good thing or that it's better than what we have right now than there are astronomers who think the sun revolves around the earth. You know, so, I mean, if that's the way you want to deal with his analogy, it's just to point out that it's stupid. So, yeah, it is true that most economists, if you poll them now, would not want to go on a gold standard, but I mean, it's not like the idea is so ridiculous and obsolete that it's, you know, anywhere approaching something like the phlogiston theory or rejecting the heliocentric model of the solar system. Okay, what else we got here? Lewis says, talking about debates, quotes, and such kind of stuff, is previous written permission required for quoting Mises, Rothbard, or any other scholar when writing an academic paper? Well, if you need previous permission, you're not going to get it because they're dead. You're never going to be able to write that paper. No, you. I actually really don't know what you mean. So you have to... If you're writing an academic paper and you're quoting someone, you have to cite where you got it from, or if it's an idea that you're leaning on a particular book very heavily, you want to cite it so you're not accused of plagiarism. Okay, so then he clarifies. I mean, when we quote and cite the respective sources, is there a limit on the number of words that be quoted? Oh, you mean like a copyright infringement? Is that what you're saying? Like, okay, sorry, I knew you must have meant something serious, but I couldn't resist cracking a joke. I mean, I don't know what the actual law says, but if you're writing an academic paper, I would imagine before you got anywhere near a limit where somebody would sue you saying, come on, you're basically reproducing this work for profit, and you're not using it academically, I would think your paper would already not be good from an academic, like, it would be a bad paper if you were quoting that much. You know what I'm saying? So I don't think you should ever hesitate. I mean, how much could you possibly be quoting? I mean, I'll just leave it there to say that if you were ever, I mean, you shouldn't be quoting 10 pages in a row anyway, just because that's too much for your reader to have to go through. Like, you should break it up if that's what you're going to do. So, I mean, if you were, like, for example, Henry Hazlitt in The Failure of the New Economics, he goes through the general theory point by point. So, I mean, it's not like he literally quotes the whole thing in the book, but he must quote a lot of it in that book. But that's clearly, you know, the publisher of the general, whoever owns the rights to the general theory, couldn't sue Henry Hazlitt for that, because he's going through and breaking it up. It's not like that's going to hurt sales of the general theory, because people would buy that rather than buying the general theory. I mean, they might not buy the general theory after they read Hazlitt because he blew it up, but so anyway. I mean, if you were really concerned, you could go Google. I mean, I'm sure that's got to be out there somewhere. Just it's probably called academic fair use, would probably be the relevant legal term. And like I said, I can't imagine. The only way would be, like, if you started making money off something, then people might get upset. But, I mean, if you're doing it, like, for example, I sort of stole the song, you know, the Krugman song that I did, the parody. I mean, that's, I didn't pay anybody because I didn't get any permission to do that. Well, I'm taking, the song is a Buckingham song called Susan from the 1960s. And I went and got the karaoke version of it on iTunes, and then I, you know, sang my tracks over it. And I suppose if that thing got 100,000 hits and I started making money from the ads on it or something, somebody might sue me or tell me to take it down. But I think before, until that happens, no one really cares. Okay, George Smith says, any comment on Ann Barnhart's Going Golf? I just came across that today. Somebody sent it to me. Here, I'll just read some of it in case people don't know what he's talking about, and I guess I can post it too. So here's the link if anybody wants to look at that, and I'll just read a quick excerpt. So this is from The Blaze, which is that sort of drudge type site that I think Glenn Beck's people put together, or they're affiliated with it. All right, so Ann Barnhart describes herself as a, quote, old-school commercial hedge broker specializing in cattle and grain, end quote. And she just shut down her business by delivering a passionate and chilling open letter posted on her website. And then this is quoting from her thing. I could no longer tell my clients that their monies and positions were safe in the futures and options market because they're not. And then she goes on to say, everything changed just a few short weeks ago. A firm led by a crony of the Obama regime stole all of the non-margin cash held by customers of his firm. Let's not sugarcoat this or make this crime seem complex and abstract by drowning ourselves in $6 words and uber-technical jargon. John Corzine stole the customer cash to MF Global. Knowing John Corzine and knowing the abject lawlessness and contempt for humanity of the Marxist Obama regime and its cronies, this is not really a surprise. What was a surprise was the reaction of the exchanges and regulators. Their reaction has been to take a bad situation and make it orders of magnitude worse. Specifically, they froze customers out of their accounts while the markets continued to trade, refusing to even allow them to liquidate. This is unfathomable. The risk exposure precedent that has been set is completely intolerable and has destroyed the entire industry paradigm. No informed person can continue to engage these markets, and no moral person can continue to broker or facilitate customer engagement in what is now a massive game of Russian roulette. Well, some strong words, and unfortunately, I don't really know. I haven't been following that MF Global thing, so I don't know enough about it, but yeah, I mean, if the stuff she's saying is true, if her description is accurate, and again, I've just been reading the headline, so I don't know. But yeah, it looks like if the guy running that literally was raiding customer accounts, and then like the regulators came in and allowed people to keep trading, but didn't allow those customers to be able to just get out and sell, that's pretty crazy. But I mean, I'm assuming that is what happened. Otherwise, that'd be kind of weird that she went so nuts and posted that. But like I say, I don't know. I guess the other thing about this Obama the Marxist stuff, I don't know how to deal with that. Because what they're doing is not Marxism. What they're doing is, if you want to call it something, is more like fascism. And the other thing is, I don't really think Obama's running the show. I'm more of the school that says, you know, the politicians are sort of front men that whoever it is, I guess bankers, if you had to, you know, pick some category to call them. But it's more than just bankers. I mean, it's also like people who control the media and stuff. I mean, I think those are the real wielders of power. And, you know, they have a lot of influence as to who ends up being the president or the prime minister or whatever, and they pick those people partly on the basis of, they're going to do what we say. And you know, so I think Obama really wanted to be president, and he was willing to do whatever it took. And they knew they could work with him, and he was real refreshing, and that, you know, the people would vote for him. And then he gets in there, and he does the exact opposite of what he campaigned on. I mean, not just in economics and all kinds of stuff. I mean, the guy wins a Nobel Peace Prize and then, you know, invades Libya. So, what can I say? It's true. Now, I guess what you could say is it's possible that Obama is double-crossing those guys. And you could say that really, deep down, he is a total Marxist. He knows full well that these sort of crony capitalists were, you know, trying to use him, and that he's going to actually spin things, and that this is advancing his Marxist agenda, even though technically it's giving a bunch of tax dollars to big bankers, which, you know, you'd think if you were a Marxist, the last thing in the world you want to do would be to bilk the general public and reward the richest people on earth, which is what Obama's been doing. So, you know, who knows? But I guess what I'm saying is these people who look at Obama's past and say, yep, see, this is the stuff playing out, that doesn't make any sense to me. Because, like I say, number one, I don't think Obama has the power that these people think he does. So even if he is a Marxist, I don't think that really matters. Just like to say, whether he's a Christian or a Muslim, who cares? I mean, he's not. He can't do anything about it. And then number two, what was my number two? I forgot the number two. Oh, the policies that have been implemented are not Marxist policies. They're, like I say, if anything, they're fascist. So in the grand scheme, yeah, they're both socialism, but you know, from a standpoint of liberty versus interference with property rights, but the way that people who are specifically using the term Marxist, I don't know. I think they're throwing that term around too loosely. I don't think they're being cynical enough to put it that way. I think they're taking Obama's ideological views too seriously. That I think Obama would do whatever he needed to do to stay in power and or to get into power and then stay there. But what do I know? And I'm not saying that sarcastically. I mean, I by no means consider myself an expert on politics. Okay. Let's make sure I'm not missing. Okay, I think the next one, but if I'm missing somebody, let me know, is Barat says, how do you think someone like Krugman would respond to Rockford's criticism of the multiplier? Or do you think it would just be ignored? Well, Barat, are you talking about when Rockford did that reductio ad absurdum and showed that the, okay, so he says, yeah. So just to refresh people's memory, in case they didn't read it or they're not sure what we're talking about, remember Rothbard at one point has this really awesome, it may be one of the favorite passages I've ever read in terms of an economics book, where he goes through and tries to dismantle the Keynesian argument for a multiplier. And specifically, what he was attacking was a particular way that Keynesians in the 1950s might justify saying that there's a multiplier, let's say, of 5 on investment spending. To say that, oh, for every extra dollar in investment spending, we end up boosting GDP by $5. And so, you know, if you thought that, then obviously you could see why, if we're in a severe recession, it would make sense for the government to come in and start spending money building bridges and stuff. So, the way Rothbard dealt with that is he looked at their argument. Their argument was showing the tautology, the accounting identity of, you know, national income equals consumption plus investment plus da da da. And then he said that, you know, statistically, historically, income tends to be 20%, or sorry, investment tends to be 20% of that. And then he just did some rearrangement to find that, oh, look, that means there's that five times investment equals GDP, and so therefore, or national income, I should say. And so therefore, if we multiply that, then we'll make the other thing go up by a factor of five. So, and then the way Rothbard blew up that particular argument was to do the same approach, except to decompose national income into the income of the guy reading Rothbard's book at that moment, and then the income of everybody else. And so then, you know, if you thought about it, say historically, the guy, you know, who's reading Rothbard right now is like one millionth of GDP. And so you rearrange, do the algebra, that means there must be a multiplier of a million or whatever on that guy's income. So the way to really get rich, the way to really boost the economy is to just give this guy money. You know, have the government give him a check for $1,000, and when that guy goes and spends it, man, we're going to get a $1 billion increase in GDP. So I think Krugman would have to concede, you know, if somebody forced him to deal with that, he'd probably have to concede that, okay, if all we had to rely on for our knowledge of the multiplier were that particular argument that Rothbard took on, then yes, it would be open to doubt that we wouldn't know if there was a multiplier or not, because that particular argument by itself doesn't prove it. But Krugman would go on to say, we have a lot more in our arsenal to prove to you that there's a positive multiplier or a multiplier greater than one than just that that one argument that Rothbard admittedly dismantled. Just for example, on his blog within the last couple of days, Krugman was talking about these two empirical studies that use various approaches to econometrically estimate what the fiscal multiplier is. So they were, I'm getting them mixed up, but like one of them, what were they looking at? I don't think it was defense spending. My mind is blanking right now, but there are empirical studies that try to isolate that stuff to try to deal with the issues of what's called endogeneity. So, because the problem with all that stuff is the only reason you engage in stimulus spending is when the economy is depressed. And so it's hard to separate out those two different things. And so that's why Keynesians can say with a straight face, after unemployment went way up, you know, far higher than they had projected after the Obama stimulus went through, is they could just say, well, you know, the baseline trend was worse than we realized, but still the stimulus made us better off than we otherwise would have been. And you can't really, it's hard to refute that. You know, you can't just point at the numbers, because the numbers have to be interpreted with a theory. So anyway, they come up with ways that they try to get around that stuff. So they try to look at cases where the government spent a lot of extra money not because the economy was bad, but for some other reason. And so a classic example would be if there's a war, because then the governments typically jack up their spending, and it's not because unemployment's real high. And so then they can look. So that's the kind of stuff they do. And now even there, there's all kinds of problems with it. And I was just arguing with this guy, Daniel Kuhn, who's I don't know if he calls himself a Keynesian, but he certainly takes pains to defend the Keynesian position from Austrian assaults. And, you know, he was talking about these empirical studies that Krugman cited. Because what they were doing, I didn't read the thing, so I'm just going off of the secondhand reports. But they were breaking it down into like a county level thing. And so they were looking at if the stimulus funds hit this county over here, but stimulus funds didn't hit this county over there, well then how much, you know, did unemployment go down where the money hit, and did it not go down where the money didn't hit, and then isn't that a way we can sort of tease this out? So it was something like that, and Kuhn admitted that if those were the numbers and we were originally at full employment, then even though the estimate would still pop out of a multiplier of 1.5, because that's the number that shot out of this model, we would know that it would have to be wrong, right? Because if you're already originally at full employment, it can't possibly be that you can get the economy to produce even more just by having the government spend money. That it has to be the case that if you expand employment in this sector over here by the government spending money there, you must be destroying jobs elsewhere in the economy to perfectly offset that. Right? And just government spending money can't create people out of thin air. And so if you're, yeah, sure, if the government spends $1 billion building a bridge somewhere, you can look at that and see all the construction workers and all the resources going there and go, oh, that's great, there's a lot of economic activity. But again, if you were originally at full employment, then you know it has to be the case that those resources are just getting diverted from other places. So my point to Daniel was, okay, if you admit then that the numbers that are popping out of this study, if we had been originally in full employment, that even you would admit that, okay, this study really isn't a smoking gun, that these numbers are just wrong. You know, so you're admitting that it's possible the techniques used in this paper are exaggerating what the multiplier is. And I said, well, then why do you trust them now that we're starting out not full employment? You know, so his point was, you know, now because we have a huge reservoir of unemployed workers, I do think that the numbers popping out of this study are correct. And so I was just pointing out to him that, look, the reason you think they're correct is because a priori you're assuming that Keynesianism is true. You think that there is a multiplier when the economy has slack in it, and you want this study to tell you what the number is. But why are you trusting this study when you just admitted if the economy were originally at full employment and this study shot out the same number, you would say, no, that number is bogus. The multiplier is actually zero right now. So how do we know the multiplier is not zero right now, even without full employment? Because that's the question. You know, so I was just pointing out to him that he was using his antecedent Keynesian framework to interpret this stuff, and so he shouldn't think that, oh, okay, I've independently now confirmed my theory because this study shot out a number of 1.5 on the multiplier, when again, he himself would admit under certain circumstances that number would be totally bogus. So the Austrians are just saying maybe it would be bogus even at less than full employment. So anyway, that I think George asked me that. For sure, I think Krugman would say there's all sorts of other arguments Keynesians use besides that one that Rothbard took on. I don't know if he would even concede that Rothbard blew up that one. I mean, he might not, but I don't see how we could avoid it because it seemed pretty straightforward that Rothbard dealt that one a blow. Okay. George Smith says, and I think this is the last question so thus far, so if you guys have more or if I missed one, just please repost it because I skipped it unintentionally. So George Smith says, do you know what classes you will be teaching in 2012 at the Academy? One for sure I'm going to teach is, and this is the one that will be the next big one that will roll out, I guess, for January at some point, probably mid-January it would start, is something on the theory of money and credit, but with an emphasis on the business cycle. Because I think a lot of people want me to, you know, we've been getting inquiries, people want me to do something on the Fed or the business cycle again. But also since I had that study guide to the theory of money and credit that came out, I kind of wanted to do something on that also. And they seem similar enough. Like, I don't think I could do both of them. And so I thought I would just merge them into one so that we'll, technically the class will be on the theory of money and credit going through that, but we'll spend most of the time, or not most of the time, but the purpose of the class will be to build people up to be able to handle the part of the book where Mises goes through what was basically the first exposition of the Misesian theory of the business cycle. Because actually, to really get Mises' full vision on that, and then to know, like, for example, people say, oh, you Austrians think the business cycle, the Fed causes the business cycle, but you're a bunch of idiots because we had business cycles before the Fed was formed. So sit down. And that's actually not right, that if you read the theory of money, I mean, for one thing, the theory of money and credit came out before the Fed existed, but it's more general than that. Strictly speaking, Mises and Hayek and Rothbard did not blame the business cycle on central banks. They blame the business cycle on an expansion of what's called fiduciary media, meaning they blamed on the banks, like the commercial banks, and said that what happens is they expand the supply of credit, and that causes the boom, and then when they panic and start clamping down on it, that's what causes the bust. So what is true is that having a central bank exacerbates that, because a central bank removed a lot of the market's checks on private commercial banks being able to expand credit in that fashion. But Mises' theory is not a theory of how do central banks cause business cycles. It's more a theory of how does fractional reserve banking cause business cycles. And if, other than that, though, George, we're pretty open. I mean, I may, well, for sure, the teacher's manual, so the Lessons for the Young Economist, you know, that textbook that I wrote that was aimed at younger readers, they are now preparing the teacher's manual to that. So it took me forever to get that thing finished because I was doing, like, sample quizzes, and then I had to write the answers to it and everything. It took forever. But anyway, that's all off my plate now. It's in their hands. I don't know what their production timetable is, but at some point, I hope before the summer, they will have the teacher's manual to accompany Lessons for the Young Economist. And so it would probably make sense for me to have another session of going through Lessons for the Young Economist, like I've done twice before, since I think there'll probably be a lot of newcomers into that area because of the text or the teacher's manual coming out, like a lot of homeschooling families. So that would also, I don't know when that would be. So that's probably also going to happen in 2012. But other than that, I'm pretty wide open. Gilberto is asking Anatomy of the Fed. Maybe, but I'm not sure, because that might overlap a lot with this thing I'm going to do on the theory of money and credit. So if I were going to do that, it wouldn't be until like the second half of 2012, since I'd want to, you know, space it out from the theory of money and credit one. And then some people, hang on a second, let me pull up, because somebody recommended something and I jotted it down. Somebody said maybe I should have a class on different ideas for how we build a free society. So not going through necessarily the theory, or maybe we would go through the theory in the beginning just to round the class out, but the person was saying, you know, it's like to talk about the Free State Project and to talk about Patrick Friedman's seasteading enterprise. And to, you know, oh, what if, you know, why don't you just go to Australia or stuff like that. So I'm thinking about, like I said, it's hard to know how much, you know, to get enough content to make it a full class, but that's one possibility that somebody suggested that I thought that didn't actually work. So with all this stuff, if you guys ever have an idea of a class, you know, go ahead and throw it out. I'm not guaranteeing you will do it, but if it looks, basically, it's got to be something that we think has enough appeal that we're going to get at least 50 people to sign up for. Otherwise, it's hard to do. Oh, yeah, and George, you also, I think you were the one who suggested a class on equilibrium. That one, I'm not sure. I have to think more about that because it's, I mean, I personally think that's fascinating and would love to do it, but it might be a little bit technical. Like I was saying, I'm not sure how many people would get to sign up for that one. Okay, Jeff says, how could a PhD economist not have the curiosity to investigate the ideas of Mises? DeLong isn't dumb, right? So what explains the embarrassing remark about the labor theory of value? Well, I mean, you're right, he's not dumb. And he actually, that's what's so, I don't know what the term is, frustrating about DeLong is, he does read this stuff. I mean, so he's going through, at one point, I don't know if it was last year, and I have no idea what even put him onto this, but he was just going through the theory of money and credit and just like pulling out passages to post on his blog and say, look at this crazy guy. Which, on the one hand, is annoying, but on the other hand, hey, at least he's going through the theory of money and credit. I mean, that's not something that Krugman's going to do. So, DeLong, I mean, I guess there's no such thing as bad publicity, right? But I almost would rather him be going through and trashing Mises as long as he's quoting him, because then that sort of sets us up to be able to defend him and, you know, gets people to think that he's somebody significant that you have to grapple with one way or the other. Now, to answer your specific question, I mean, let me just look at that. Because the point is, DeLong is trying to understand the ideas of Mises. Let's see. So DeLong says, you know, from my perspective, the interesting thing is that von Mises appears to believe all of the following, and then he lists four propositions, and then starts just going through saying, how could anyone think all four of these things at the same time? That doesn't make sense. And the specific problem is, like, his number three, this is what I said in the comments to DeLong. So DeLong's third proposition is, moreover, an increase in the real money stock that comes about from people spending time, energy, and resources digging gold from the ground and refining it is equally efficacious in curing a depression. And that, I don't think that's right. And that's what I said to him in the comments. I said, it's true that Mises and his followers support, you know, using gold as money, but they don't think if you're in the middle of a bust that the way to get out of that is to have workers go dig up gold. That, you know, Mises, to my knowledge, never said anything remotely like that. And certainly I don't remember Rothbard saying anything like that. And so I said, so I think when you're saying nobody could possibly believe all four of those things, part of my answer is, yeah, because that third thing you're attributing to him, he doesn't believe. So you can go ahead and rest easy now. And then I also said, if you know somewhere where he did say that, then give me the quote, and I'll stand corrected. And he hasn't said anything, because, like I said, I don't think such a quote exists. With all that stuff, the point is, DeLong actually does spend a lot more time reading Austrians and even like old school Austrian stuff than just about any other critic of them. Certainly more than Paul Krugman does, but he wants to find crazy stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's going in there hoping to find Mises saying something. I was gonna say baddie, and I was trying to remember why that was popping in my head. And it's because that's what DeLong, the last time he went through theory of money and credit, he was referring to some of Mises' passages as bat, S-H-I-T, crazy. Right? He just kept referring to, you know, various passages from the theory. Like, so DeLong has already made up his mind that Mises is just nuts. And so, like, for fun, for sport, he likes to just, you know, occasionally go through and say, oh my gosh, look at this, guys. Can you believe this nut job said this stuff? And we've still got people today who believe in him. So, I mean, it's kind of like a lot of the people on my blog agree with me that the market monetarist, like the guy Scott Sumner, I mean, I can't get too upset with DeLong for calling Mises or saying Mises has a mental disorder, because I routinely say that this guy Scott Sumner is insane. Now, I would like to say that it's more in good fun when I say it, and Scott thinks it's funny. I mean, he disagrees with me, but he thinks I'm being funny. Whereas, you know, I think DeLong is saying that with hostility. It's not like DeLong is really saying, oh, okay, you know, Ludwig, you and I are pals, and we're all trying to find the truth here, but I disagree with that at this point. But in any event, the people on, you know, I read Scott's blog, this guy Scott Sumner, who thinks Bernanke has had too tight of a monetary policy. And incidentally, I'm debating Scott Sumner in January sometime on the Mises Academy, you know, through this forum. So I mean, it's a similar thing there. Like, I go to his blog almost hoping he's going to say something crazy in my mind so I can go quote it and put it. And I, in my mind, I do try to understand what he's saying. Like, so in other words, I would never deliberately misrepresent his position. And I would often, you know, I'll say stuff like, wait a minute, but Scott said this last month and now he's saying this. So that's a contradiction, isn't it? What's the deal with these guys? I don't understand them. And so I think it's a similar thing with DeLong. So probably Scott and his fans get frustrated and think that I'm not really trying. And part of it is because once you've decided that somebody is totally wrong and says completely outrageous things, then you can go through their work and that stuff, you know, you can see it that way. So obviously I think DeLong is wrong in his interpretation of Mises, and I think I'm right in my interpretation of Sumner, but that's at least when you want to understand the psychology of, you know, how could someone read Mises and come away thinking that, that's what happens. Any other questions? So, unless you guys answer me another one, I'll just elaborate on that. So I think the thing with DeLong is he's misunderstanding when the Austrians are supporting gold as money. And so, like I say, I think he believed, well, I know he does that because he said that he attributed it to him. So he thinks, in Mises' mind, in, you know, 19, because here's what's going on. They don't understand, like, and by they I mean like Krugman and DeLong and people like that, they don't understand that the Austrians, at least like Mises and Rothbard and people like that, they completely reject the whole framework with which Krugman and DeLong analyze the economy. So, for example, you know, so DeLong is utterly convinced that what the problem was in 1933 was that there was an excess demand for money, or, you know, for liquid assets, let's say, not just money per se, but money-like things. And that was the problem. And so that's why there's a surplus supply of goods and an insufficient supply of money. And so that's why DeLong thinks, so what you do is you just, you know, give people more money, duh. And he knows Mises is against that, because Mises said he was. So then, but he also knows that Mises believes in gold as money. So to DeLong's mind then, oh, so Mises must think that in 1933, the right policy would have been to just have everyone, you know, to solve this excess demand for money problem, we just should have had people go and dig up a bunch of more gold. And that would be the way to augment everybody's cash balances. Because Mises clearly doesn't want us to print up unbacked money to solve the excess demand for money problem. He must want us to go dig up more gold. But that's stupid. So, okay. So see, so now Mises for some reason thinks that yellow metal does something special that a green piece of paper with Andrew Jackson's face on it can't do. But that doesn't make any sense because, you know, we know that value is subjective and that it's not the intrinsic properties of money that matter. Right, so I think that's where DeLong is coming from. And so the crucial problem there, the mistake that's, you know, like step one of his argument, is that he thinks the problem in 1933 was this excess demand for money. And that the way you satisfy that is to increase the quantity of money. And he just assumes that Mises must think the same thing. And then, you know, to flesh out Mises' view then, he says, well, the guy must think we should go dig up more gold. But that's not the issue. Mises thinks prices should fall. And that's the way you cure this so-called excess demand for money. And that, you know, Mises would point to all of the Hoover administration and New Deal measures that were propping up prices and preventing liquidation and so forth. Yeah, George Smith is asking me, do I plan to write a Mises.org? Yeah, that's partly why I'm spending so much time on this right now, as I'm sort of talking through it to see what I'm going to say. Jeff says, I would love to see DeLong's criticisms. What are they? You mean that where he's calling Mises bat dung crazy? That stuff? Let me see if I can find that one. The problem is apparently he uses that phrase a lot, because I just tried Googling it and there's lots of hits. Apparently DeLong uses that phrase for a lot of people. So Jeff, if you want to just Google, I saw some stuff, I didn't see any links to DeLong's actual thing. So if you Google bat, S-H-I-T, insane, Mises theory of money and credit, you'll at least see people referring to DeLong saying that. But if you want to go click on those, then maybe somebody links to it. That would be my suggestion. But just now, I couldn't get to the actual link. Okay, Gilberto says, do you plan to go through the whole theory of money book during the class in January? Probably not the whole. I don't know. I have to look at it. Probably not the whole book, because that's a lot of material, and also, I don't want to make it that intimidating. All right, so it's a layperson could profit from reading portions of the theory of money and credit without reading every last page. And so I think I'll probably try to just do certain chapters that are, what I'll do is, what do you need to read from the theory of money and credit so that when you walk away from the enterprise or the exercise, you really know Mises' theory of the business cycle? That's the goal I'm going to have for the class, and so I'll pick the readings accordingly. So we'll end up reading most of the beginning because he lays the foundation, but then we might start skipping around once we get into the middle of the book. Okay, well, let's stop there. Thanks for tuning in, guys, and I will remember to take your quizzes if you're taking the course for credit. And our last class is this coming Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving. So do your reading before class. See you then.